accession number 17392, reel 1.
Vice Marshal Hedgeland, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
At Maidstone, in Kent.
Which year was this?
1922.
Did you have your education in Maidstone?
Yes, I was the pupil of Maidstone Grammar School.
And after that?
After that, I left rather earlier than I intended because it was the Battle of Britain. I had just taken my higher school's certificate and was embarking on the scholarship sixth form work when the Battle of Britain blew up, and we had to share our school with one evacuated from London. It was impossible to do any serious studies, especially as the physics master left to join the army. So I left on my 18th birthday and took a job with the BBC as a junior maintenance engineer, first of all working in London at Maida Vale Studios and Broadcasting House, and then down to Evesham, which in those days was a big studio centre. It's currently used for training engineering staff. And I didn't pick up formal studies again until 1948, but a lot happened in between, of course.
What were the formal studies you picked up in 48?
I went to City and Guilds College of Imperial College of Science and Technology, read for a degree in electrical engineering.
Now, did you hear Neville Chamberlain's broadcast declaring war on Germany?
I did indeed, yes.
Under what circumstances?
Oh, I was waiting to be called down to the town to help with the reception of children evacuated from London. And I heard it on the family radio.
How did you feel about it?
Difficult to say. I suppose a mixture of excitement and foreboding, realizing that I was approaching the age where I would probably be involved. My father was possibly more worried than me because he had lived through the worries of the First World War.
What happened when you received the evacuees? Can you paint the picture?
Well, we used what was called the Agricultural Hall in Maidstone, and there were reception parties allocating the children out to the homes, taking them away. I was asked to provide some form of musical background through a PA system with some gramophone records and so on. And of course, no sooner had we got things going than the sirens went, and we all were told to move away from the centre and stand close to the walls. That's about all I can remember now.
Were the evacuee children a pathetic sight or not?
I wouldn't say pathetic.
Where had they come from?
London, as far as I know.
And your school was shared with evacuee children?
Yes, from the autumn of 1940, when, as I said earlier, things started to hot up. I think it was a grammar school from Lewisham area that came down and used our premises for half the time. Of course, the other factor was that with frequent air raid warnings, we had to get down in underground shelters which had been constructed in a hurry, so that the time available for serious studies was very small.
How did the sharing of the school work out?
Well, I was only subjected to it for less than 2 months, and as far as I can recall, it was simply on a time basis that they had the school half facilities half the time and we had the other half, but I mean that's about all I can remember now.
Did you have any first-hand experience of the Battle of Britain?
I certainly watched it with great interest. It happened that I was in charge of a party of Maidstone Grammar School boys. I was a prefect by that time, assisting in the hop picking on the Weald of Kent. And of course we had a grandstand view, and it's a memory that one will never forget, seeing the formations of Heichels and Dorniers coming over, the crackle of the machine guns from our chaps, aircraft spinning down, parachutes opening, and so on. And there was one day when I had, as a matter of fact, been sleeping in late because I'd joined the LDV, as it was called, later the Home Guard, as having been a member of the Officers Training Corps, and I'd been on night duty, got up about 11 o'clock, and the sirens went, and I went out to the garden of our house in Maidstone and was counting the formation of Heichels going over the top, and I suddenly heard this rushing noise and lay flat on my face, and the bomb went off in the next street. That was my only personal experience of being close to anything like that.
What was your address in Maidstone?
8 Hale Road.
And the street where the bomb dropped?
Oh, it was round the corner. I can't remember the name now, I'm afraid.
What was the effect of the bomb?
It demolished one house and damaged several others. Can't have been a very large one. I believe it was one of a stick of bombs, because part of the museum in the centre of Maidstone was also damaged at that time.
Did you ever visit any of the sites of crashed or brought down aircraft?
No. No. I might, if you wish me to say any more about that period, when I joined the BBC, as I said earlier, I was working in London at first. This coincided with the night attacks, and on the night of, I think it was the 30th or 31st of December 1942, I was travelling back from Maidstone, having been home because I had been working over Christmas, and in a coach. The railway was so unreliable, being damaged so many times, that I used Maidstone District coach. Got as far as Eltham, and the sirens went. By the time we got to Victoria coach station, all hell was let loose. It was the night of the big fire bomb raid on the city. And I remember standing outside Victoria, seeing the whole sky lit up with the fires and searchlights coning, guns banging, waiting for a number 11 bus to get me down to my digs in Chelsea. And blow me down, a number 11 bus came along.
That was December 1940, I think.
Sorry, yes, 1940.
Did you see much of the destruction in London or anywhere else caused by enemy bombing?
Oh yes, in the West London, I didn't go down to the city at all, but Oxford Street and around Chelsea. Flood Street was pretty close to where my digs were in Oakley Street.
How did public morale seemed to stand up under the bombing.
Very well, I think.
Did you ever come across anybody who wanted to come to an agreement with Hitler as a result?
No, no, not at all.
Can you tell me more about the nature of your work at the BBC?
Yes, I joined the recording section, or put it giving its full title, technical recording section, because it was recording sound, just as we are doing now, not recording on bits of paper. I operated the original steel tape machines, the Marconi steel machine, the Marguerite sound system disc recorder, which used acetate discs, and the most advanced recording system we had then was the Philips Miller film system, which engraved in effect on the surface of a quarter inch film with normal emulsion. It cut into the emulsion and recorded a varying area of light through which, or transparency through which light could pass, so that it was read off by a photoelectric cell afterwards, and it had a very excellent frequency response for its time, up to 9 kilohertz, very low noise background. Had in fact been used for recording programs of Radio Luxembourg when J. Walter Thompson used to record the shows like the De Broglie Summers Orchestra in London and sent the tapes over to Luxembourg.
What were the main problems, technically and otherwise, that you had in doing that job?
No great problems. I just found it quite a lot of fun, actually. However, when I moved down to Wood Norton, that's at Evesham, I was transferred after a while to studio control room work, where the job entailed checking out the studios prior to transmission, operating the controls in the control room, and also if one on one shift one did the appropriate job of connecting up and testing the landlines to distribute the programs through London or to Daventry from the shortwave service.
Do you remember whom you were working under?
I can remember quite a few names, yes. The engineer in charge was a Mr. Perslow. There were two deputy engineers in charge, Mr. Coker, and oh dear, I can't remember the other man's name. And of course I was on shift, so there were people in charge of the shift, senior maintenance engineers.
Now, can you tell me how and when you came to be in the RAF, please?
Yes. The BBC had an arrangement that, having taken on youngsters like myself at age 18, that they would get 18 months work out of them. That involved, of course, some delay in call-up, so that when I'd passed the age of 19, I realised that I was going to be called up, and I decided at that time that I wanted to volunteer for aircrew. Now, it so happened that a fellow billety, I should have said that at Evesham I was billeted on a farm, initially with three other BBC engineers, but latterly just one other chap of my own age. And it so happened that his father was a group captain in the Air Ministry, and John Wilcock, that was my colleague, came back after one leave and said, "Father says on no account should you volunteer for air crew, because they're desperately short of people to work on RDF, as they called it then. And he had me go for an interview, and to cut a long story short, I was fortunate enough to be offered a direct entry commission as an acting pilot officer on probation.
When was that?
In June of 1942.
What was the next step?
Next step was to go to the officer school at Cosford for 6 weeks. I was then sent to a ground radar station at Stoke Holy Cross near Norwich, pending going on a proper training course on radar, as we call it now. I hadn't been there more than about 10 days when I received a posting, not to the big school at Yatesbury, which was full at the time, but to an overflow course at TRE Malvern in their own small training school. And I started to learn about the fundamentals of radar at the beginning of August 1942. I was told at the time I was likely to go on ground radar convoys to North Africa, but after 2 weeks I was boarded, as were other officers at Malvern on training, and selected as one of four to join Bernard Lovell's team on H2S. So that was mid-August.
What did the team consist of?
Oh, well, the entire team was I couldn't really elaborate on it, but Bernard Lovell was the head. His deputy was a Dr. Thompson. And I suppose there were 15 or 20 engineers working very closely with EMI, who did the engineering for production. The early flight trials were going on at that time. But in September, my job, and I would remind you that I was a bit very low level of seniority and experience at that time, was to try to get to know about the equipment in sufficient detail so that in the afternoons I could pass it on to a group of Canadian radar mechanics. It turned out that we were destined to go out with the first H2S equipment to the Pathfinder Force, which I did on the 4th of November 42. I was asked to drive a setup in a 1500 weight Bedford signals van, which I'd only learnt to drive just beforehand, to an airfield at Gravely near Huntingdon, which I reached on the 5th of November 42. And it was my first sight of an operational airfield. I had been working before I left TRE at the airfield at Defford, where there were lots of aircraft on trials, but as I said, Gravely and 35 Squadron, which I joined as their radar officer, was the first operational unit I'd seen.
What parts had you played before that in the development of H2S?
Well, as I said, my job was to find out from the EMI engineers the details and then train the mechanics. So I really wasn't doing any development work myself at that time. My job was going to be, and was for some considerable time afterwards, keeping it operating.
How was H2S received by those who were to operate it at first?
With great enthusiasm. It was quite a challenge. There's a tendency for people to think that it produced a radar picture of the ground that was very easy to interpret. Nothing could be further from the truth, certainly, of the early equipments. The presentation was very crude and required a great deal of skill to interpret it and determine which of the responses displayed on the tube were significant.
Why were the displays at first so crude?
Well, there is reasons, principally, I suppose, because using a 10 centimeter wavelength, which was the only frequency available from magnetron at the time, which itself was a very new device. It had only been first demonstrated, I think, in 41, something like that. And with the aerial aperture confined to 3 feet, gave a beam width of the order of 10 degrees, so that a point, if there was such a thing as a point source of an echo on the ground, would be displayed as an arc subtending at least 10 degrees from the center of the rotating trace on the tube. There was were also problems with the vertical polar diagram, that the responses tended to fade and come back again during the approach to a target. These sort of things had to be taken into account. The focus of the tube was not pin sharp, although that was not very significant, as the responses themselves were so crude at that stage. Of course, later on, late in 1943, a 3 centimeter magnetron became available, which enabled the beam width to be reduced to the order of 3 degrees, and the indicator circuitry was cleaned up to some extent. Method was used to try and minimize another problem in displaying the fact that what the radar sees is the slant range to the target. So if you were 20,000 feet, the ground range should have been measured from a point 20,000 feet below you. So as you got closer and closer to the target, the signals became more and more cramped, eventually finishing up with a black hole, which the distance which corresponded with the height of the aircraft above the ground, which was where the first response was coming from. But it was possible later to develop a time-based circuit that speeded up the trace at the start and slowed down later on to minimize this distortion.
And how long were you with 35 Squadron at Gravely?
Until March of 1944. Perhaps going back for a moment to when I arrived there, if that's all right with you. We had a month during which we were training the operators and trying to get the bugs out of the system, and the cooperation with the aircrew and the technical team, myself and the boffins from TRE who came up to help in the early stages, and the Canadian mechanics, was extremely close. In fact, the flight commander of 35 Squadron, Wing Commander Peter Cribb, later an Air Commodore, actually moved his flight office into my office in the radar section, so that we could work very closely together on the training. And we reckoned that 35 was ready to go into ops at the end of December. 7 Squadron with Stirlings were the second squadron to be fitted, and they came slightly later, and it was ruled that we would go into operations together. So in effect, 35 Squadron had to wait another month until the first operation, which was on the night of 30th to 31st of January 1943. Incidentally, that was 10 months after the first flight of a primitive development H2S set. So it was 10 months from a pretty ropey lash-up to going on operations. If you compare that with the time it's taken to get other radars on which I worked after the war, years were taken to get from development. Having said that, of course, it was a relatively simple system. But on the other hand, it was all new territory. Nobody had done anything like it before.
Do you remember the night of that operation?
Yes, I do, very clearly. Mm.
Can you take me through what you remember, please?
Well, of course, there was an air of expectancy and worry about how the equipment would work, and we waited on the ground desperately for news. So happened that the weather was turned out to be absolutely appalling. The raid, incidentally, was on Hamburg, but some of the aircraft had to turn back because they got into severe icing conditions. Those that did get through were very impressed with the clarity of the radar picture of Hamburg, which was relatively easy because it was on an inlet, and you get good contrast between the sea and the land. But on return, the weather was appalling also, and one of our aircraft landed at Witten rather than at Gravely and had a minor taxiing accident. We had another of our aircraft that landed at Gravely skid off the runway, which blocked the runway for another aircraft, which was damaged slightly. So it was quite a hairy night, by and large. On the other hand, as I said, those who did get through to the target were very enthusiastic. Bernard Lovell came up to see the crews when they got back, and it was quite a moment.
So that was the two squadrons, 35 and 7?
Yeah, 7 were based at Oakington near Cambridge. There were 4 squadrons originally in the Pathfinder force. 35 came with Halifax's, came from 4 Group, and 7 with Stirling's were already at Oakington from 3 Group, and 156 had Wellingtons at that time. They happened to be detached to an airfield called Warboys, which was another satellite of Witten, and they stayed there. An 83 squadron with Lancasters came down from Lincolnshire to Witten. The Wellingtons never got H2S. They were the squadron re-equipped with Lancasters, and 7 squadron converted to Lancasters from Stirlings, and we on 35 eventually did also in March of 44, just around the time I left the squadron. I was posted on promotion to flight lieutenant to Witten as the station radar officer, where 83 was one of the squadrons. There were some mosquito squadrons there as well.
What did the H2S sets look like at this time?
Do you mean physically?